This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Zona Plus, an effective non-drug treatment for high blood pressure. It's a safe, easy way to lower your blood pressure naturally, and it's so effective it works for 9 in 10 people. The Zona Plus is a high-tech smart device that guides you through a patented therapy that's personalized to your unique physiology. To find out more, go to tryzona.com or call toll-free 888-408-6141. As a listener to Intelligent Medicine, you can get $50 off and free shipping. Just use the coupon code Hoffman at checkout at tryzona.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to talk about a fascinating subject. In the past, on Intelligent Medicine, I've had the occasion to interview my esteemed colleague, Dr. Nicholas Gonzalez, about his extraordinary work, primarily in treating cancer. He was an innovative, natural cancer therapist, but he was more. He was a theoretician. And I use the past tense because, unfortunately, Dr. Gonzalez passed away a couple of years ago. He died, unfortunately, an untimely death, but he left us a legacy that really is remarkable. And I wanted to revisit that because, posthumously, they're publishing his extensive books. And this book really deserves attention because it doesn't just deal with cancer. It deals with the scheme for looking at disease in a profoundly original way. It's entitled Nutrition and the Autonomic Nervous System, The Scientific Foundations of the Gonzalez Protocol. And with us today is one of the, shall we say, acolytes of Dr. Gonzalez. He is an internationally renowned clinician, researcher, author, and lecturer in the field of trauma-related disorders. And he's founder and president of the Colin A. Ross Institute for Psychological Trauma. But he has a tremendous interest in perpetuating for posterity and for the scientific community the works of Dr. Nick Gonzalez. And so he's here today to discuss the book, Nutrition and the Autonomic Nervous System. Dr. Ross, it's a pleasure having you on Intelligent Medicine.
Yay, I think that's an very good name for a podcast. I wish there was more intelligent medicine around.
Indeed. Well, you know, I think it kind of sums it up because, you know, we take the best of both worlds. You know, there are breakthrough innovations in high-tech medicine. But of course, there's a lot of excesses and problems associated with high-tech medicine. And I think that that's exactly the approach that Dr. Gonzalez took. He recognized that there was a lot of, you know, remarkable progress being made in medicine. But he also felt that what was being de-emphasized and ignored in mainstream medicine was a more nutritionally oriented perspective, a more, shall we say, naturopathic perspective on treating disease, and he really beautifully integrated that in his practice and in his writings. And so the first question I'd like to pose to you is, how did you get personally interested in Dr. Gonzalez's work? Because you are a psychiatrist. You're not a cancer practitioner.
Right, exactly. So I don't treat cancer. I'm not a nutritionist. I'm interested in all kinds of things. And as you mentioned, my main focus is psychological trauma and all its effects. So this was a sort of accidental encounter in that I read one or two of Suzanne Summers's books because my girlfriend was reading them and her friend was reading them. And I remember reading one, being quite impressed by it. And I remember, I couldn't remember the guy's name, but I remember there was this doctor who was having 10 plus year survivals for stage 3-4 pancreatic cancer. And I remember thinking to myself some years back, well, if I ever get pancreatic cancer, I'm going to that guy. And then I kind of didn't think about it that much more until our friend's now husband started developing symptoms of sort of a pre-multiple myeloma condition. and some pretty severe symptoms, and some of his blood values were up and so on. And so,
for our listening audience, this would be in pre-multiple myeloma. You see anemia, you see fatigue, you see a decline in the vibrancy of the bone marrow. If you do a bone marrow biopsy, you see a lack of active replicating cells, sometimes an infiltration with myeloma cells. It's a sort of a degenerative form of cancer. It's slowly progressing, but it can be fatal and debilitating.
Right. And he had massive night sweats and had a monoclonal gammopathy where one of his antibodies was way, way, way too elevated. So he went to see Gonzalez, got on the protocol, is adhered to it incredibly well, and has done extremely well. And so we were over at his house one day, and she of the couple shows me this book about the trophoblast and cancer. And I thought, trophoblast cancer? What's that got to do with anything? And I opened it up, and I remember reading literally the first page I read going, hey, wait a minute, this completely makes sense. And so that's how I got into it, read some of the Gonzalez books, ended up having lunch with him in March 2015, a few months before he died, and really just decided, you know, as a citizen, as somebody who's had friends, relatives die of cancer, as a physician, like, we can't just let this drop from the planet. This is too amazing. So after his death, I've co-edited two collections of case histories and the Nutrition in the Autonomic Nervous System book and a special issue of a journal as well. And the more I learn, the more amazed I am by it all. So he's got in this volume 111 cases of cancer and one diabetes case.
In fact, it's fortuitous because I just opened, I just got home and there was a box waiting for me. And it was volume 2 of Conquering Cancer, 62 patients on the Gonzalez protocol. And it's some of the final writings and final notes of Dr. Gonzalez describing the case histories of very remarkable case histories of patients with very advanced cancers who he essentially healed, kept alive, prolonged the lives of many. In some cases, patients were cured. With very, very challenging forms of cancer. So there's something to it. There's something to it.
Yeah, the first volume is all either pancreatic cancer or breast cases. So, and then the second volume is a whole variety of different types of cancer. But the pancreatic cancer cases are especially instructive because they're all MRI, biopsy confirmed, many of them diagnosed at Mayo Clinic or MD Anderson or in places like that. So there's no doubt about the diagnosis. Stage 3, 4, metastases, inoperable, many of them. It's a death sentence. So like life expectancy is under a year on average. And he's got many people alive, feeling well, vibrant, functioning 10 plus years later. It's just unheard of in all of oncology. Regular oncologists just don't get these outcomes. What really caught my attention.
And a little known fact is that while Gonzalez was well known for his cancer therapies, he also opened his practice to other patients with really stuck kinds of problems. He saw patients with chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia, post-Lyme syndrome, patients who were debilitated and didn't respond to conventional treatment and often had success with them. And I can attest to that because I was a patient of Dr. Gonzalez. I didn't have a very serious problem. I had an allergic problem. I had a very itchy skin condition that was driving me crazy. And I knew Nick. And I called up Nick once and I said, you know, Nick, I know you treat mostly cancer patients, but would you accept me as a patient? I'll pay you full freight. You know, let's not do professional courtesy. I want you to treat me objectively as if I were, you know, just an ordinary person. And he said, sure. And he offered me a dramatic diet change because at the time I was a vegetarian. He said, that's not working for you. You're too alkaline. I didn't know what he meant by that because I thought alkalinity was the end-all and be-all of nutritional science. You want to be alkaline. But in his scheme of things, too alkaline was bad. He told me that I needed to eat meat. And I said, well, I haven't eaten meat in 17 years. Do you think I'll I'll be able to tolerate it? And he said, sure you will. I said, well, maybe I can do it two or three times a week. And he said, no, you need to do it about two or three times a day. And I said,
well, I said, Nick, pretty amazing diets.
Yeah. I said, Nick, what should I have for breakfast? He said, have a steak or a lamb chop. You know, and I said, this sounds crazy, but I went to the butcher and got a bunch of meat, turned my diet around, took the supplements that he recommended, which were kind of idiosyncratic because I was used to taking, you know, all the right supplements. I took a multi, I took, you know, all the right and trendy supplements. He said, don't take certain ones. They're not good for you. Take only these. And within a couple of months, the problem resolved, never to return. So, I experienced personally the power of this. Well, thank goodness I didn't have advanced cancer. So it seems to me that the basis of his treatment was individualized nutrition and supplementation and various detoxification methods. Of course, pancreatic enzymes played a big role in this. But he didn't treat the cancer the patient had. In other words, he didn't say, well, you have breast cancer. We have a protocol for that. He treated the patient who had the cancer, right? He more focused on the terrain, the balance, the sort of the milieu in which the cancer arose, and treated that imbalance.
Actually, I think he did both approaches. It's a little bit different if we're in the cancer world, because in the cancer world, it all hinges on the pancreatic enzymes. That's the core anti-cancer agent. Mm-hmm. And there's a whole trophoblast model that I can give you like the ultra quick summary of.
Sure.
So basically, it goes back to this guy, John Beard, late 19th, early 20th century, who is a histologist, embryologist, and by thousands and thousands and thousands of hours of studying slides of all kinds of creatures at different stages of fetal development, he noticed that the cells that form the trophoblast, so the individual cell is a trophoblast, the tissue is the trophoblast converts over to become the stable placenta. And he noticed a couple of things. One is that a bunch of trophoblast cells actually split off and seed around all the other organs of the body during fetal development. And then he noticed that in humans, when he finally got to studying humans, around about day 57 of the fetal development, the placenta settled down and became the stable placenta at the same time as the pancreas started to produce pancreatic enzymes. And so
the fetal pancreas.
Fetal pancreas, yeah.
Yep.
And so this is an observation he made. And what are the properties of normal trophoblast cells in the trophoblast tissue? Well, their job is they have to invade the wall of the uterus and grip into it. So they have to be invasive, migratory, they're undifferentiated primitive cells. They're angiogenic, which means they create their own blood supply. They don't stick together. They don't have normal cell adherence, which is why some split off and seed around the body. And they're resistant to immune surveillance, which they have to be because half of their DNA comes from the father.
Mm-hmm.
So the mother's immune system is going to recognize them as like a foreign body, a transplant, and attack the baby and kill it. So in order to not be killed by the mother's immune system, you have to resist immune surveillance. And all these properties of normal trophoblasts are the properties of cancer cells. So then he thought to himself, John Beard, well, wait a minute. If trypsin, pancreatic enzyme, is the signal that causes the trophoblast to settle down and become non-malignant, maybe we could treat cancer, because his model of cancer is it's not – like say it's breast cancer, it's not a normal breast cell that de-differentiates backwards and becomes a breast cancer cell. It's really one of these, what he called wayward trophoblasts, that somehow escapes from normal dormancy and starts doing what trophoblast cells do. It multiplies, it invades, it creates its own blood supply, resists immune surveillance. And there's good science now showing that these trophoblasts kind of morph in the direction of the surrounding tissue because of signals, biological signals in the surrounding tissue. So if a trophoblast escapes control in a breast, it kind of morphs to look somewhat like a breast cell, brain cell, and so on. And this is how we got to, okay, we're going to pile on the pancreatic enzymes orally. And he started having all these amazing results. And that was all forgotten. And then it was picked up again in the 60s by actually an orthodontist, strangely enough, named William Kelly, mm-hmm. who Gonzalez went and studied many of his cases and published a collection of 50 of them, and then picked up this whole treating cancer with pancreatic enzymes, refined it, developed it. So that's the anti-cancer part. But he also has a whole another arm, which is the nutritional part, which is essential to the treatment package, and especially for non-cancer diseases. And there's a whole model which is very intricate, well thought out, and very scientifically testable and researchable. And the basic concept is autonomic balance. So the autonomic nervous system is sympathetic, parasympathetic. And there's tons of physiology, and all medical students learn about it in medical school and then basically forget it, don't use it. And it turns out, if you go back to Pavlov, I actually read Pavlov's original book, Conditioned Reflexes.
Yeah, this is really interesting because I'm reading the book about Nick's book, in effect, The Nutrition of the Autonomic Nervous System. And we all know about Pavlov's dog, you know, the experiment, you know, they ring the bell, then the dog salivates, and then, you know, that whole thing. Right. And I think everybody knows about that. But there's an aspect of Pavlov's work that is completely forgotten and is quite interesting, and I think you're about to launch into it, is that not all the dogs responded identically. There were sort of several tiers of reaction to stimulus among these even among these experimental animals. So share that with us.
Exactly. So first of all, the Pavlov's experiments were quite complicated and intricate, and that's just like the smallest little summary, that ringing the bell experiment. But they would live in a kennel area, and then they'd be brought into the experimental room and somewhat cruel stuff done to them. And so he noticed, and he describes it in his book, that there's a large group of them, the majority of the dogs, they don't really like the experiments. They're not happy about going there. They don't react particularly violently. Then they go back to the kennel. They kind of shake it off and carry on as normal dogs. But a small group, which is sympathetic dominant, so this is by their genetics, by their temperament, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. they get dragged into the experiment, and they basically go into attack mode. They're biting, fighting, and when they are brought back to the kennel, they don't settle down. They stay in this aggressive fight mode. Then there was another small percentage, 10% or so maybe, of the dogs who are parasympathetic dominant. So they are brought into the lab over and over, and they have the opposite response. They shut down, they numb out, they're frightened, they freeze, they even urinate and defecate on themselves. And when they go back to the kennel, they don't shake it off either. They get stuck in that mode. Mm-hmm. So this is the original observation. Then it kind of flash forwards to post-World War II. So one guy was a Harvard professor. One guy was chairman of physiology at University of Minnesota. Mm-hmm. They both had hundreds of papers, animal experiment physiology papers, in mainstream journals. And they worked out this whole system, experiments with dogs, cats, and a lot of studies by this guy Funkenstein mm-hmm. with humans. And it turns out mammals in general, human beings, about 10% by nature are sympathetic dominant, 10% are parasympathetic dominant, and then it's kind of a bell curve in between. And
Can you just review the distinctions for those who don't have, a grounding in basic physiology? You know, the distinction between the sympathetic nervous system and the parasympathetic nervous system, in brief.
Sure. Well, these are two parts of your entire body's nervous system that are controlled by your brainstem. The sympathetic is more the fight, alert, eyes wide open, heart going, blood supply to the muscles, shunt the blood away from digestion and sex organs. So that's the threat in the jungle, immediate fight mode response. The parasympathetic is more what I described with the other set of Pavlov dogs. It's all about slowing your heart rate down, shunting blood over to digestion, healing sexual organs, reproduction, and so on. And your blood pressure drops down. So it's the two basic responses to the outside world. And
both of which are good. They should be in balance because you need both.
Right. Right. So they're built in because they make sense and they're good. But like anything, you can be out of balance and stuck over at one extreme or the other. And so basically, building on Kelly, that Gonzalez worked up a set of metabolic types based on how you are on this spectrum. And then he's got a whole scheme for and a whole rationale for why you need this set of nutrients, this kind of diet, if you're sympathetic dominant. And there's also, we need research on this. There's really no research, but there's a model, a prediction that if you're way over sympathetic dominant, you tend to have solid tumors. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you're over parasympathetic dominant, you tend to have white blood cell leukemia style tumors. Mm-hmm. So that's a very, so that's not a fact. That's a model, a theory, but it's very testable. So I'm interested in, I'm not an oncologist. I'm not a nutritionist. I don't plan on treating people myself. I'm interested in really trying to get some interest and some money to look into the science of all of this and really kind of prove it up in the lab and in human research as well.
So in brief, what would be the characteristics of someone who is sympathetic dominant, who has an imbalance in that direction, versus someone who is parasympathetic dominant? Is there a archetype or a typical pattern of symptoms or maladies?
Yeah, it's just kind of what I've been describing. So the type A person is going to be always ready for a fight, revved up, aggressive,
hypertension,
domineering.
Perhaps. So that would be associated with it, yeah.
Yeah, so your blood pressure's up, your pulse is up, so that's wear and tear on your cardiovascular system. The parasympathetic dominant person is more passive, more tends to shut down, numb out, not be aggressive, and be more easily dominated.
Allergic type or person with fatigue or allergic problems.
Right.
Asthma
problems. Right, so all these things need a lot more research, but this is kind of the lay of the land picture, mm-hmm. which Nick Gonzalez had very huge amount of detail. And where you are on the spectrum determines, do you need more calcium, more this, more that? And he had some rationale for all of that, which is also researchable. That's the basic picture.
Okay, great. So we've laid the groundwork for a discussion of different strokes for different folks when it comes to supplements, when it comes to nutrition, based on the Kelly metabolic types that Dr. Nick Gonzalez spent time studying. I mean, he actually took a hiatus between his pregraduate studies and his postgraduate medical school studies to literally sit down with this William Donald Kelly character, and he really was kind of a character. He's an eccentric. He was an orthodontist. He wasn't a physician, but he was sort of a mad genius type who came up with this formulation. And then he took that basic paradigm, combined it with some other insights, and developed a style of practice which he embodies in his book, Nutrition and the Autonomic Nervous System. So when we return in part two, we're going to take a look at some particulars. You know, what do you do diet-wise for certain types of cancer? What do you do for diet-wise for certain types of autonomic nervous system imbalance, medical conditions that reflect either a sympathetic overdrive or parasympathetic imbalance? Continuing our discussion today with Dr. Colin Ross. Dr. Ross is the author of the foreword to Nutrition and the Autonomic Nervous System, and has developed a deep fascination for the methodology of the late Dr. Nick Gonzalez. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.